One day, after Moses had grown up, he went out to where his own people were and watched them at their hard labor. He saw an Egyptian beating a Hebrew, one of his own people. Looking this way and that, and seeing no one, he killed the Egyptian and hid him in the sand. The next day he went out and saw two Hebrews fighting. He asked the one in the wrong, "Why are you hitting your fellow Hebrew?" The man said, "Who made you ruler and judge over us? Are you thinking of killing me as you killed the Egyptian?" Then Moses was afraid and thought, "What I did must have become known." When Pharaoh heard of this, he tried to kill Moses. But Moses fled from Pharaoh and went to live in Midian, where he sat down by a well. Now a priest of Midian had 7 daughters, and they came to draw water and fill the troughs to water their father's flock. Some shepherds came along and drove them away. But Moses got up and came to their rescue and watered their flock. When the girls returned to rule their father, he asked them, "Why have you returned so early today?" They answered, "An Egyptian rescued us from the shepherds. He even drew water for us and watered the flock." "And where is he?" Reuel asked his daughters. "Why did you leave him?" "Invite him to have something to eat." Moses agreed to stay with the man, who gave his daughter, Zipporah, to Moses in marriage. Zipporah gave birth to a son, and Moses named him Gershom, saying, "I have become a foreigner in a foreign land." During that long period, the king of Egypt died. The Israelites groaned in their slavery and cried out, and their cry for help because of their slavery went up to God. God heard their groaning, and he remembered his covenant with Abraham, with Isaac, and with Jacob. So God looked on the Israelites and was concerned about them. Christians want to serve God. They want to be faithful, active in their ministry for the Lord. When you become a Christian, this is one of the changes that happens to you. Before you were a Christian, your hopes and plans centered around yourself, your desires, your ambitions. But when you're saved, you start to feel a greater concern for other people. You want to do something for God. You want to give towards the Lord's work. You want to start telling other people about Jesus. But sometimes that initial zeal that you have for God wears away in the face of the harsh reality of life. People aren't as appreciative as you thought that they would be. You realize that you're not as effective as you hoped you would be. You also find that you still struggle with sin and you're not living quite the life that you really hoped that you would. And so you become discouraged, even cynical, no longer so eager to serve God. I wonder if that's what Moses felt by the end of this chapter. He's made his choice, as we saw last week, not to be known as the son of Pharaoh's daughter. He's turned his back on the wealth of Egypt, having been brought up in Pharaoh's palace. He's turned his back on the passing pleasures of sin. He identifies himself with his fellow Hebrew or Israelites, and he is full of zeal to help them. But soon, he's running away from Egypt. He's settling in a desert land called Midian, far away from his own people. What's going on? Where is God in all of this? How does it help us to continue serving God? So we're going to look at this story of Moses. And we begin with Moses and his misplaced zeal. Moses, as a young man, is full of zeal. You can see this in this chapter. Just think of that time when he comes to this well in Midian, and he sees how these female shepherds, these girls, are mistreated by the other shepherds, driven away. And so Moses, he steps in. He's full of zeal. Not only does he stand up for them, but he waters all their flock. He's a man full of zeal. And he cares about his fellow Israelites in slavery. He went out to watch them as they're treated so harshly by the Egyptians. And he wants to do something about it. And so, when he saw an Egyptian, presumably one of these slave masters, beating one of his own people, he couldn't bear it. As this Egyptian beats this poor Israelite, maybe even trying to beat him to death, Moses intervenes. He checks this way and that. There's no one looking. And he takes hold of that Egyptian and he killed him. Now, Moses knew it was murder. He knew that this could lead to all kinds of trouble, and so he quickly hides the body. And the next day, he goes out again. He has a sense of mission from God. Actually, Stephen, when he recalls these events in Acts chapter 7, says this: Moses thought that his own people would realize that God was using him to rescue them, but they did not. He has a sense of mission. He wants to rescue his own people from slavery to the Egyptians. So I suspect as he goes out this next day, he's on the lookout for the next abusive Egyptian. If he can kill them off one by one, and maybe rally the Israelites to do the same, well, soon they'll be free. Well, whatever his plan was, it is short-lived. He sees two Israelites fighting. This is no good, he thinks to himself. That they need to be united. They need to stand as one against the Egyptians, not fight each other. And so he intervenes. He asks the one who was in the wrong, "Why are you hitting your fellow Hebrew? What's going on here? Don't you realize how foolish this is?" Moses, of course, expects a positive response. But instead, he's rejected by the Israelite. Verse 14, the man said, "Who made you ruler and judge over us? Are you thinking of killing me as you killed the Egyptian?" The Israelites appear more ready to than to fight the Egyptians. What's more, the man whom Moses had rescued the day before seems to have told lots of people about it. How else did this Israelite who was fighting the next day know about what had happened? And you can just imagine Moses thinking something like this: don't these people understand? You know, if you want to start a resistance movement, you need to keep quiet. But Pharaoh hears. Moses' plans are over. He has to flee from Egypt. All his zeal to help and rescue his own people, all of that has come to nothing. Now, what's going on here? What's going on? You see, Moses has been zealous for God. But I don't think he's been zealous for God in God's way. He wants to fight Egypt in his own strength. He wants to unite Israel by his own force of personality. But this wasn't to be God's way. He wanted to act secretly, hiding that body that he killed. But God's plan would be to have Moses go directly to Pharaoh and to say, "God says, let my people go." It wasn't to be a resistance movement. It wasn't to be hidden. wants to rescue Israel for their sake. He sees their suffering. And of course, that's good up to a point. But God's plan was not just to rescue Israel, but also to judge Egypt for his own glory. Later, Pharaoh will say, "Who is this Lord that I should obey him?" And Pharaoh is going to have to see that the Lord is God. Moses' plans were in the wrong way and weren't big enough. He has a zeal for God, but it's not in God's way. Let's just pause there for a moment. It is good to be zealous for God. But it's easy in our desire to see the church, for example, flourishing. And when it doesn't, we become impatient with people. Or in our zeal for the gospel, we just rely on our own strength, on our ability to make arguments, to be persuasive, on our energy. How often the church has adopted the wisdom of the world rather than relying on God. In its desire to grow, how often has the church softened the message of the gospel? Doesn't want to mention sin or judgment or anything that might be unpopular. Oh, that'll just turn people away. How often, if you read books on church growth, they'll tell you to put your money and your time into marketing. Follow the best business models. Now, it's not that we're to be old-fashioned, inefficient, and offensive. But what really matters is that we're zealous for God in what God tells us to do and in what God tells us to be. The weapons of this warfare but are spiritual. Jesus calls us to live in love and unity. And that is the power. By this will everyone know that you're my disciples, if you love one another. A community of people that love each other, that forgive one another, that don't hold things against one another, that let past things be past things, that keep meeting together, that care for one another. These are the things that God tells us to do. He doesn't give us a manual of church growth. He tells us to love one another. He tells us to be kind, to care, to do good. Let me encourage you in those things. And when we proclaim the gospel, he tells us to proclaim with boldness, not to be afraid, not to be afraid of rejection, but to hold firm to the words of Jesus, because as Peter said, you have the words of eternal life. And we're to rely on the Spirit. How do you know when people are relying on the Spirit? They're prayerful. They're not looking to their own strength and their own wisdom, but they pray that God will give the increase. Moses, he was zealous for God. That was his personality. Defending these women at the well, trying to rescue the Israelites by his own strength and in his own wisdom. He's got lots to learn. Let's be zealous for God, but let's be zealous in God's way. Let's think about Moses and his years of preparation. Moses, he has to flee from Egypt. He goes to the land of Midian. We don't quite know why he chose Midian. I guess it was a neighboring land. Verse 15, when Pharaoh heard of this, he tried to kill Moses, but Moses fled from Pharaoh and went to live in Midian, where he sat down by a well. What's going through his mind? His hopes are dashed. But then he meets the daughters of the priest of Midian. Interesting, isn't it? How often a future wife is met at a well in the early books of the Bible. I kept looking for these wells when I was a single man, but couldn't find any. But anyway, here he is. He's at the well. And his zeal takes over again. He helps these daughters of Midian. And it's such an amusing picture, isn't it? When the girls returned to rule their father, he asked them, "Why have you returned so early today?" And they explain about how this Egyptian, Moses, had rescued them from the shepherds, even draw water for them and watered the flock. And I love this phrase, "And where is he? You know, why have you left him there? Bring him home. Show some hospitality. Show some gratitude to the person who's helped you." And so Moses is invited into this home. And he agrees to stay. He's settling down. It becomes clear that for one of these seven daughters, and Reuel is more than happy to give Zipporah to Moses in marriage. In time, they have a son. And the picture here is of Moses settling down in a new country. And on first reading, it looks like Moses has given up on his people. They didn't want his help. He can't go back to Pharaoh. Pharaoh's trying to kill him. Well, he's just having to make a new life for himself in Midian. He's making the best of it. He's got a new family. Evidently, we'll see chapter 3, he tends the flock. He's working as a shepherd. It's his new life. But turn to Hebrews chapter 11. Those words that we read. Hebrews 11 and verse 27. "By faith, Moses left Egypt, not fearing the king's anger. He persevered because he saw him who is invisible." Now, I used to think that was referring to Moses leaving Egypt with the people of Israel at the Exodus. But actually, it isn't talking about that. Because the next verse, "By faith he kept the Passover." Well, the Passover happened just before they left Egypt. So I think verse 27 is talking about Moses when he leaves Egypt at the age of 40. By faith he left Egypt, not fearing the king's anger. He persevered. He was invisible. You see, it's easy to look at Exodus chapter 2 and think, well, Moses has forgotten his own people. He's forgotten about God. He's just started a new life because that's what he's got to do, and he's making the best of a bad job. He's trying not to think of the disappointments from the past. But no. He left Egypt by faith. He's persevering. And actually, when you look back in chapter 2, we have an indication that he still believes in God. He still believes that God will deliver his people. How do we know this? Well, when he names his firstborn son, he calls him Gershom. You know, it's a big thing, naming your child. You don't just randomly pluck a name out of the air. You think long and hard about it. You have long discussions with your husband or wife. Moses, in naming his son, is doing so in faith. Look at what it says, verse 22. "Zipporah gave birth to a son, and Moses named him Gershom, saying, 'I have become a foreigner in a foreign land.'" You see, he's not become one of the Midianites. He's not settled in that sense. Oh yes, he's lived there many, many years. But he still feels that he's a foreigner. Why? Because he has not forgotten his people. They are his real people. He is still a man who trusts in God. He has not forgotten his own people. He does need another 40 years of preparation. Moses wanted to rescue his people at the age of 40. God waits until he's 80. There's only one person here today over 80. It's a long time. Okay, he'll live till he's 120. People did live a little longer in those days. So, you know, maybe he wasn't a frail 80. But nonetheless, it's a long time. He has these 40 years in the land of Midian. Now, already he's been educated in all the wisdom of Egypt. And what good preparation that was. He will know how to approach Pharaoh. He's not going to make silly blunders in Pharaoh's court. But his education, I think, has left him somewhat self-sufficient. It's taught him to rely on his own ability. That's what education does, isn't it? The more educated we are, the cleverer we think we are, the more self-sufficient we become, the more we learn to rely on our own wisdom, on our own ability. And in one sense, that there's a lot to be said for that. We need to be educated. But the problem was, Moses was leaning on his own strength and wisdom rather than God's. He tries to rescue the Israelites by his own strength, by his own ability to rally them against the Egyptians. His failed attempt at rescuing Israel by his own strength and through his own skill as a leader actually had shown him up. But even that one failure was not enough to prepare him. Oh, he has to reflect on that failure. But he needs 40 years. He had to be in the desert of Midian. No doubt, you can see some wisdom there. After all, the people are going to be led through this very desert on their way to the promised land. Surely it's good preparation that Moses should spend time in the desert learning to survive in such an environment. But surely a year or two, five at the most, would be long enough to learn some desert survival tactics and skill. Not 40 years. Why such a long time? Well, it seems to me Moses needed these years of obscurity if he was to become what is described in Numbers 12 and verse 3, the humblest man on the face of the earth. Age 40, he is not the humblest man on the face of the earth. He needs 40 years to learn to rely less and less on himself and more on God. So it wasn't so much desert survival skills or Egyptian court etiquette that he needed, valuable as they may have been, but it was complete trust in God to overcome Pharaoh, to cross the Red Sea, to receive that manna day after day after day, and to call forth water to pour from the rock to feed the millions of people. Moses would need complete reliance upon God. And he would need unusual humility to cope with the people who were forever complaining, accusing him of this and that, being ungrateful, and rebelling against God. When we're told in Numbers 12 and verse 3 that he was the humblest man on earth, it was the occasion when his own brother Aaron and Miriam were complaining that he had too much authority. And he doesn't stand up for himself. He's humble. He's learned to be humble. His rejection in Egypt by that Israelite was a little foretaste of how the Israelites would always be. That actually is the point that Stephen makes in his speech in Acts chapter 7, that again and again the people of Israel reject God's appointed person just as they rejected Jesus. He needs 40 years to prepare him for such a people. Many of you knew my father, who passed away 3 years ago. He was a missionary in South Korea with my mother. But the most fruitful time of his whole ministry was not in Korea, where he spent about 10 years serving, but was in Germany in the 1970s as my parents worked amongst Korean immigrants. Dozens and dozens, scores and scores were saved. And looking back over my father's life, it's easy to see how God was preparing him for that fruitful time in Germany. Firstly, he'd learned Korean, a difficult language. Not all the missionaries bothered to learn Korean, but used an interpreter. It was the fact that he could speak Korean that opened up the door for him to hold these meetings all over Germany with Korean immigrants. They were homesick. They wanted someone who could speak their language and teach them about God. The fact that he married a German wife, who would never have been in Germany, wouldn't have known about all these Koreans in that country had he not married my mother. Even his experiences as a young boy doing national service in Singapore and feeling so homesick prepared him to identify with these Koreans who'd come over, often just as 18-year-olds, to Germany feeling utterly homesick. God had prepared him in all these ways. But more, there was the spiritual preparation of learning to rely not on himself, but on God. Because there were less fruitful years. Those 10 years in Korea were not always so fruitful. There were times of great need when he had to learn to trust God when everything looked bleak. God prepares his people. We're told in Ephesians 2 and verse 10 that God has prepared good works for us to do. God has a plan for your life. God knows what you will be doing in the future. God knows how he wants you to serve him. He's prepared those works, but he's also preparing you. We don't know the future. We don't know how hidden or how obvious those good works will be. For some, it's very evident that they're serving God fruitfully. For others, it's much more of a quiet life, and yet just as important. And we can see from the life of Moses that God is preparing him, humbling him. So be patient. Be patient. You know, I first sensed a call to Christian ministry. I was still a medical student. I wanted to stop my studies there and then, go straight to Bible college and get into Christian ministry as quickly as I could. But you know, it was the story of Moses waiting 40 years. It was the story of Joshua, who was assistant to Moses for 40 years. It was the story of Paul as he is converted and eager to preach the gospel, but then has to spend 3 years in Arabia. Again and again, God says, wait, you're not ready yet. You need to learn humility. You need to learn to trust me. You need to learn to live in harmony with people. You need to learn to be able to those difficult times. You see, maturity doesn't come quickly. You go to an antique shop. You're not going to be very impressed if you... Oh, I took some scales to a charity shop the other day. They looked quite nice. You thought, yeah, but we didn't need them. They're quite bulky, these sort of kitchen weighing scales. Looked on the back, you know, obviously recently made. Charity shop. If that had been an antique, bit battered, cast iron, evidently old, quite different. We probably would have kept it. We would have made space for it. You can't produce an antique. You can't produce something of maturity and worth overnight. Go round an antique shop. Look out for the cheap things that have been made to look old. You don't want them. You see, it takes time for you to mature. It takes time to grow in humility. It takes time to learn to trust God. The difficulties and the stresses that you experience today are all part of God's preparation. You feel homesick. You feel useless. You feel a failure. Like Moses. You feel you're just living a life of obscurity. Then say, thank you, God. Thank you. Because you're preparing me. We know he's got good works for you to do. He's prepared them. And he's preparing you. Be faithful in a few things. Because Jesus tells us that those who are faithful with a few things will be entrusted with more, be that here and now, or even in the age to come. You know, the Israelites may well have wondered if God would ever hear their cries as they cried to him year after year, and yet year after year, nothing was happening. But had God forgotten his promise to Abraham? No. Verse 24, God heard their groaning. And he remembered his covenant with Abraham, with Isaac and Jacob. So God and was concerned about them. But he didn't rush. He waited for Moses to be ready. God was preparing his man for his time. Just as God prepared his son, Jesus. Just at the right time, he sent him into the world. How long the people of Israel had waited for their Messiah. 400 years without a prophet. From the time of Malachi to when John the Baptist came. That's a long time. And yet there were a faithful few who kept waiting. And then in the fullness of time, Christ was born of a woman. And even after he was born, with all the promise at Christmas of the angels speaking and proclaiming good news, then there's 30 years of quiet. Jesus himself is prepared. He learns obedience through the things that he suffers. Though he's perfect, even Jesus has to learn. But then he starts to preach the good news. And then he starts to do those miracles and to heal the sick. And then he starts to tell his disciples that he's going to go to the cross. And he's ready. He's prepared. A body have you prepared for me, it says. And he dies on that cross, taking our sin. And here is God's way. And then the glory. God has his time. God sends his Savior. God prepares his servant. Let's trust God. Let's trust him. And let's be ready to serve with the same zeal that we had when we were first saved, but with greater humility, with greater trust in God. Let's pray.